This is a wonderful transition. Hal Harris from Durham University in England, Northern England, a noted labor and business historian, and Chad, who is an aspiring labor and business historian, a doctoral student at the University of Albany working on a dissertation on employer associations. And what I'd like to do is take our discussion now into the 20th century and into some of the themes suggested by Reginald Jones's comments, which although only suggested, not really in the detail. I didn't play that section of the interview that would have touched on what we're talking about. But we're talking really about employers and capital and how they retain control and how they deal with the threat of unionism and with the threat of the growing encroachment on their territory of the state. We haven't touched on that subject, so maybe we can begin with that. We're talking about the beginning, the progressive era, the coming of the progressive era, when the state was beginning to pass all sorts of legislation that influenced the workplace. So why don't we take up how business responded to progressivism and then later the New Deal?
Okay. I mean, I think that to continue what I was saying before the break, what we have, and following on from Reginald Jones, what we have is some strategic thinking. What we have in business, particularly in the early 1900s, but I mean, there are predecessors in the 1870s and 1880s. One of them, an important New Yorker, a guy called Abram Hewitt, who was an extremely significant player in the railroad and coal mining industries and steel, and was also a democratic politician. And the crucial thing about Hewitt is that he started thinking far ahead. He started thinking what business wanted, and what business wanted that was to keep its future in its own hands, to have the freedom to decide how to determine employment policy. And Hewitt, from the 1870s and 1880s, was wise enough to understand that it was not sufficient simply to mobilize your forces when it came to conflict. You had to be preemptive. You had to think long term. Now, he was before his time, but in the 1900s and teens, loads of other American businessmen and their advisors began to think long term. They didn't just respond to crises, whether it be crises of labor shortage as during the First World War, or crises of industrial conflicts as in the early 1900s. They didn't respond to things just in a kind of a retail fashion. They developed a vision of the good society, and the good society was going to be one where workers were not were not class conscious, where workers were content and ambitious, where workers were, you might say, happy consumers and cooperative producers, and where workers actually were prepared not just to be obedient, but actually to lend to the companies that they worked for their intelligence and to kind of contribute to it. And building that vision of the company as a kind of a productive and harmonious enterprise, it's not just rhetoric. That's something that runs alongside the conflict with trade unions that becomes quite acute from the early 1900s on. And it seems to me that strategic vision of a good future is that's been a guiding star that American employers haven't given up on from that day to this. And now, by the early 21st century, then many, many American employers are in a position where they can actually realize that vision. If they wish, you can take the low road of deunionization and low wages and negligible benefits and the substitution of American workers by cheaper overseas producers, or you can take the high road of the creation of high performance non-union management systems. And that high road, I think, has clear historical antecedents the best part of a century ago.
And that's, I mean, we've all written on this, on welfare capitalism and how it evolved in the 20th century and rendering workers irrelevant, really, by providing workers with the type of benefits that unions normally battle for. Some historians have emphasized, well, that would never have come about without a strong union movement pushing it forward. Others suggest other routes for that. Well, what happens when you have a Great Depression, as we do in the 1930s? Can companies continue, progressive companies, continue to take that road? Or is there something else fundamentally change?
Some can and some do. Something that when I wrote my first book, I wasn't aware of, but I don't think anybody was really that aware of it at the time, was the significant extent to which pre-New Deal patterns of employment, patterns of non-union employment continued even through the 30s and 40s. Sandy Jacoby, a professor of management in University of California at Los Angeles, in his last book, Modern Manners, he did a great service by reminding us that the victory of the state-supported New Deal labor movement was never total, that the collapse of welfare capitalism and of employer self-confidence and the ability to hold on to their own power, that was never total, even in the worst days of the 1930s, and that there were firms figured out how to survive, how to chart a course through rough waters. Eastman Kodak, for example, in Rochester, is one of them. And I think that for the reconstruction of a non-union employment system in the US after the Second World War, the fact that you do have these very significant holdouts carrying on right throughout, that helps to explain the ability of American employers to kind of, you might say, get back on track once the political environment becomes more conducive, which it does from about 46, 47 onwards.
Yesterday in conversation, you said that the rise of industrial unionism may have been an aberration instead of just a part of the long track of the rise of trade unionism and organized labor. And it seems more and more that that's correct. Do you strongly feel that, or how strongly do you feel it? And Chad, you know, join us on that one too, especially since you're an organizer for the CWA. What's your take on this too?
Certainly. Well, unionization rates have been steadily declining since the 1950s, and a large part of that is the role of employers in discouraging unionization in a variety of ways, through both the carrot and the stick. You have the welfare capitalism programs that Howell Harris has discussed, but you also have, you know, when there are unionization attempts, there's quite a bit of resistance, and that takes a variety of forms. You know, in today's modern age, you know, with letters to individual employees, to captive audience meetings and firings and that sort of thing. And that's been happening very aggressively recently, but we certainly see much of this happening in the early 20th century as well, when employers are saying, you know, you don't need a union, this is an open shop, meaning you don't have to, you can be an individual. We see the same kind of language being used today.
Yeah, historians getting to thinking of Jerry's question about the long view. Historians and political scientists, or well, political sociologists, have spent a lot of time thinking about what they call American exceptionalism, the way in which patterns of political belief and political behavior and class organization in the United States differ from what one sees in some other advanced industrial societies. And a few years ago, a political sociologist called Karen Voss wrote what I thought is a very good book about the 1870s and 1880s. And what she argued is really that the United States was actually very, very comparable to other Northwest European industrial societies up until then. It was in the 1880s in particular that you could see the institutions of American exceptionalism, a particularly weak state, a feeble labor movement, a lack of any kind of ideological challenge to capitalism within an organized working class. Voss argued that that was when those distinctive features of American exceptionalism really came to the fore. I would add to that that the 1870s and 1880s is when we can see the first signs of American employer self-organization, their strategic vision, their creation of their own vision of a good society that protects their power, but not exclusively. It's 125 years on now, and it's in that long time period that I think that the New Deal labor movement, the late 1930s to the mid-1970s, it's a big blip. It's a 40-year period, but within a 120-year period, there's a certain sort of symmetry to it now. Ever since, really quite shortly after the Second World War, the inability of the American labor movement to hold on to what it had, to break through into new territory, whether new territory geographically in the South, or new territory in terms of new kinds of jobs and new kinds of workers away from the industrial shop floor. The signs were all pointing the wrong way by the late 40s, early 1950s. Since the mid-1970s, it's been bad news all the way. So now we've got 30 years to look on. And in the last 30 years, I think one can say that, you know, American exceptionalism, or to put it another way, American normality has been quite thoroughly reconstructed. And trade unions still exist. They may indeed enjoy temporary resurgence or an ability, particularly unions may have the ability to break through into new territory. But I see absolutely no reason to suppose that until the end of my professional life at any rate, whenever that may be, that I'm going to be studying in the United States, where the labor history of the present is particularly interesting.
I don't know. Chad, do you see it that way too?
As grim as you do, I do. I agree that we need to look at this 40-year period or so as being, not being consistent with the rest of U.S. history. I think we look at World War One. I think was one of the first periods when labor had some legitimacy because it supported the war. And then after World War One, throughout the 20s, labor declined pretty significantly, and that process has been going on pretty consistently since the 50s, but certainly climaxing from the 70s on.
Yeah, I mean, I flew to Albany last Sunday by Northwest. A very nice flight. The plane didn't crash. It had been very adequately maintained by a replacement crew of mechanics. The airline mechanics, you might think, such a highly skilled bunch, they would be irreplaceable. They were out. They're gone. They were reduced at Detroit Airport to a few guys and some women walking around with placards. A style of looking after your own interests that it looked as if it should have been in a museum, and it was about as effective as a museum piece. So yes, I'm a historical pessimist.
Well, if indeed trade unions are down for the long duration, is there something to replace them? Is there another force, another agency, another institution in American society that could help maintain high wages, good working conditions? Are we seeing a long period of decline of those, of all of the things we associate with trade unions, but not necessarily associated with trade unions? I mean, can have an independent source, could be a political force. Mm-hmm. I mean, a political party or pressure groups or something that could replace unions.
I don't see any force that can replace unions, because one of the crucial things about trade unions is that they were mass membership organizations. And the United States is a democracy, it's not simply a consumer society. And the collapse of labor isn't just, indeed, I think it's not mainly significant, simply for the way that relations between employers and employees are organized. What it means is it takes the guts out of, it takes the foot soldiers out of, progressive or even not particularly progressive democratic politics. So it's a sort of a self-reinforcing situation whereby one can be fairly confident that the political scales will remain pretty well tilted, slammed firmly down against the interests of those other than members of the business community in the relatively settled American middle class. Getting to your question about what maintains prosperity in an economy of good wages in this situation, what will maintain it, is the requirements of the market. Now, that might seem glib. What that means is that nobody will be looking after the poor. This is the sadness, you might say, about the collapse of a mass labor movement and of progressive politics. For the majority of Americans, the decline of organized labor doesn't impinge on their lives at all. But there are people on the fringe of the working poor whose lives would be and could only be transformed by trade union membership, but they have the least likelihood of actually being able to access those services and representation rights, and nobody else will be interested in representing them either.
Well, on that gloomy conclusion, I promise that maybe in future shows we'll bring on two optimists, but this is Talking History, and we call it like we see it, or our guests call it like they see it, and we want to thank you for tuning in, the Professor Hal Harris from Durham University in Northern England, and Chad Pearson from the University at Albany, State University of New York. Thank you, both of you, for having a very interesting conversation on capital and the development of business ideology in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Thank you.
Thank you.